ISIS is not defeated. We have got to keep the pressure on ISIS so they don't recover. We may want a war over. We may even declare it over. You can pull your troops out, as President Obama learned the hard way, out of Iraq. But the enemy gets a vote, we say in the military. And in this case, if we don't keep the pressure on, then ISIS will resurge. It's absolutely a given that they will come back.
President Trump's former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis speaking to NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, urging caution in the Middle East. The president reiterated this afternoon that while he is withdrawing troops from northern Syria, he plans to redeploy them within the Middle East and impose sanctions and economic penalties on Turkey in response to their invasion of Kurdish-held territory along the border last week. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces returned to the region as part of a deal between Damascus and the Kurds. Joining us now to help unpack what all of this means for the stability of the Middle East is Jennifer Caffarella. She's the research director at the Institute for the Study of War and an expert on Syria and ISIS. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First, let's talk about these latest developments. What do you make of this agreement the Kurds have made with the Assad regime? It does seem like a big deal and a radical power shift.
It is a desperate move by our, I suppose, now former Kurdish allies to cut a deal with the Assad regime that the Kurds have actually never wanted. In this case, what they're hoping to gain is military support from the regime and likely from Russia to halt further Turkish advances into northeast Syria and to enable a counteroffensive to try to expel those Turkish forces. So it's a major win for the regime.
And who does it leave in charge in the towns in northern Syria, Kurds or Assad's regime? Do we even know?
Well, it depends on the areas. Some regime forces have already started to enter Kurdish-held towns, but the regime does not have the military forces essentially to take over all of eastern Syria or even all of the border. And so this is more limited actually in scope in terms of the change in the military balance on the ground than has been portrayed thus far.
And what about the ISIS prisoners that are reportedly released from Kurdish prisons? Are they all family members of ISIS fighters, women and children? What do we know definitively?
Thus far, around 800 family members, so women and children of ISIS, have escaped a detention annex, so to speak, at a camp for internally displaced persons. There have also been very small-level escapes of one and two ISIS fighters here and there from detention facilities, but as of yet, no major mass or coordinated escape from detention.
And these tweets coming from President Trump, without evidence, that the Kurds may be releasing these prisoners to draw us back in, is there any reason to believe that?
There isn't, because look, the Kurds are going to be, Kurdish civilians will be among the first victims if ISIS escapes detention and goes on a rampage across northeastern Syria. It simply is not likely that they are going to choose to let in these killers back into their midst. However, northeastern Syria is becoming a war zone. And the further that Turkey pushes into Syria and creates a security chaos, basically, the more likely it is that ISIS will be able to escape, not because the Kurds choose that outcome, but because the Kurds are fighting a multi-front war.
And that leads to this big question. What does this mean with ISIS? Will we see an ISIS resurgence, as Secretary Mattis suggested in that clip that we just opened with?
An ISIS resurgence is unfortunately a given. And actually, ISIS has already been resurging for months now, conducting car bombs, assassinations, and expanding its presence within the population, primarily thus far in Arab areas, but increasingly sneaking into Kurdish areas and attempting to lay the groundwork for future operations against the Kurds, as well as against their Arab partners farther south. So this is only going to accelerate that ISIS campaign.
Well, there's so many reasons to ask why the president made this decision, especially given that he's so vocal about having defeated ISIS.
Look, I think it's understandable to want to get out of these conflicts and not have to continue to deploy American forces into harm's way. But the unfortunate reality in this case is we have to choose. Either we are willing to accept an ISIS reconstitution, a new caliphate, the return of ISIS's enslavement of female populations, or we have to stay. There just is no middle ground, and that's a very painful reality for everybody involved, but it's one that we really do need to face head on.
Again, speaking to allegations from President Trump, he seems to be implying that Turkey will pick up the fight to combat ISIS. But what evidence is there that that's the case? What interest or incentive would they have?
Look, I think there's a logical argument to make that, in theory, the regional states that share a border with Syria should handle this problem. I would love for that to be true. But if Turkey were able or willing to handle the ISIS problem, the United States would not have needed to intervene in 2014 when we did. It simply is not reality, although I certainly wish that it were true.
And now let's turn to Russia. All of this seems to be a big benefit to President Putin. The deal with Assad, Russia's aligned with Syria. Russia certainly has an interest in tension between Turkey and the West. How does Russia benefit from all of this?
The American withdrawal from Syria will be a gift to Russia, just as it is a gift to the Assad regime and to ISIS. Vladimir Putin is in part in Syria in order to displace the United States as the key regional power broker in the Middle East, and we have given him exactly that.
What reaction are you seeing from leaders in Germany, UK, and European countries that have been targeted by attacks from ISIS or people affiliated with them?
Sure. There has been a European outcry against the Turkish invasion, not only because it is creating a greater risk of ISIS resurgence, but also because the Turkish-backed forces are conducting wide-scale abuses of the civilian population on the ground. But the unfortunate challenge that I think Europe faces is they can't do this alone. They can't prevent what is unfolding in Syria from happening without American leadership and without the strength and capabilities of the U.S. military. And by abandoning them and abandoning our local partner, we're unfortunately going to leave Europe to deal with the consequences of this decision, which will include likely more ISIS attacks in Europe and the potential even for more of a migrant crisis, which could further overwhelm European security.
Jennifer Caffarella from the Institute for the Study of War, and thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Coming up, Friday was a very bad day for President Trump in the courts. 5 rulings against him on 3 big issues. Our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, tallies them up. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin from Madeline Brand. Congress returns to the Capitol this week amid a growing fight between House Democrats and President Trump over the impeachment inquiry. This weekend, President Trump threatened to sue House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff. Here's Trump at the Values Voter Summit in D.C. on Saturday.
I actually told my lawyers, I said, sue him anyway. He's got immunity, but they can't mean immunity for that. I said, sue him anyway, even if we lose, the American public will understand. And sue Nancy Pelosi. Or maybe we should just impeach them.
Well, it's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here to look back on some of these interesting pronouncements by our president. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Hello, Jessica.
Hello.
Can the president of the United States sue a member of Congress? That is the question before the court.
Sure, but not for this. So, yes, absolutely. People can sue people, and that is true regardless of whether or not they are the president or a member of Congress. But in the U.S. Constitution, it says something called the Speech and Debate Clause, which essentially gives immunity to things that members of Congress say either on the House floor, or the Senate floor, or in committees. So that's the big issue here when he's talking about immunity.
Well, yes. I mean, I didn't know this, actually, and I almost wondered whether he was mixing it up with diplomatic immunity in the case of the diplomat's wife in Britain, who has diplomatic immunity.
Well, and then the second problem,
murdered a young child with the car, I should explain.
Yes. Anyway. Yes. So that is a much bigger issue, obviously, a separate issue where we've long recognized diplomatic immunity. Now, immunity for members of Congress, again, it's part of the Constitution, it's part of the speech and debate clause, because we recognize you have to be able to say certain things while you're doing your job as a lawmaker. The other thing that President Trump said is that, well, maybe we'll impeach them. Roadblock number two, you can't actually impeach a member of Congress. So we have two kind of worlds of hurt here for President Trump.
Well, one of the president's personal attorneys, Jay Sekulow, said that Trump's legal team is still looking at all options after Trump floated this possibility. So it would seem that they're looking at no options.
So looking at all options seems to me something that an attorney would say when they have a client where they have terrible client control problems. And looking at that is kind of a stalling technique, which means like I'm going to tell my client who's clearly listening that we're still looking into it. But it also is telegraphing very clearly. I'm not talking about any specific statute, any specific case law, any specific constitutional provision, likely because there are none.
Right. So they're spinning it for the client.
Yes.
Billable hours. Anyway, now to another story in the news. President Trump had a very, very bad day in court. On Friday, five federal courts rejected arguments by the president and his administration. And could you recap these decisions for us? What happened?
Yes, this is there's a kid's book, The No Good, Very Bad Day. And it was kind of like that for President Trump. So the first ruling came from the D.C. Court of Appeals, and it talked about whether or not President Trump has to turn over 8 years of financial documents, whether or not his accounting firm has to turn over those financial documents to the House. And what President Trump had argued before the impeachment inquiry is that there's no legitimate legislative purpose for that. And the D.C. Court of Appeals said, no, we agree with the district court here. There absolutely is a legitimate purpose. It's well within congressional oversight to do this. And so you need to turn that over. Now, it's not the end of the story. I think President Trump likely will appeal to either the full D.C. Court of Appeals and called an en banc appeal, or he'll appeal straight to the Supreme Court. But we're not seeing those tax returns this week.
Anytime soon. And then there were also three separate decisions on the Trump administration's new rule to penalize people seeking green cards if they've ever used public assistance. And what reasons did the judges give in three different states for shooting this down?
Yeah, there are three different district courts that made decisions on this so-called public charge change. It's something that came from the Department of Homeland Security. And they basically said, if you're a green card applicant or a visa applicant, then, and you either have a low level of education or low earning or have had public assistance, it's going to be a lot harder for your application to go through because we think that you will essentially need public assistance later on and we don't want to pay for you. And it's really interesting to read the judges' opinions because they're both based on the law that says basically Department of Homeland Security, I don't think you have the power to roll back this protection. I don't think you can implement this rule. I think it goes against the congressionally delegated power to you. And then you see a lot of angry policy conclusions where we have one judge citing the poem that's on the bottom of the Statue of Liberty. We have another judge saying this is directly against the American dream. And we have the third judge saying, essentially, have you ever thought about children and how this is going to affect them in long term, that this will actually cost people more money?
Yeah, I thought that was really striking. Did you? I mean, are you sensing a kind of welling up from the courts of, I guess, a ramping up of politicization of in their rulings?
Not necessarily. I think it's whatever comes to you, you have to make a determination. So it's not like these judges asked for the decisions, but these are inherently political decisions. And you also saw in one of these cases, a dissent by a Trump appointed judge, which was just as vigorous. And she clerked for Justice Thomas, who was one of the kind of founders of originalist thought. And she said this goes directly against what we understand. And her dissent was just as vigorous.
Well, finally, there was the ruling on funds for the border wall, also a very political issue. What did that involve, and why is this decision significant? Because it was a limited ruling.
This was a limited ruling, and essentially, everybody remembers, President Trump declared there's a national emergency. Step number one. Step number two is, what do you get for it? And what he wanted is money for a border wall. And part of the money that he wanted to use was for military construction projects. Part of the money was from counter-drug funding. Part of the money was from Treasury forfeiture.
So he wanted to divert those funds. Exactly.
He said, like, here are those pots of money. I want to use that to construct a border wall. And what the judge said is, it was a district court judge in Texas, and what the judge said is, just with respect to the military construction funds that were diverted, you don't get to do that, at least not yet. So this is a preliminary injunction, I believe. It's limited in the sense that it doesn't say you couldn't declare a national emergency or you can't use any funds at all. But it's still a significant loss for the Trump administration.
And just quickly, the questions we always have when you're here is how likely are all or any of these cases to make their way up to the Supreme Court?
Well, in an already blockbuster term for the Supreme Court. So I think that the court at some point will have to face this issue of the National Emergency Act, what type of funding you can divert for a national emergency, particularly one where there doesn't seem to be any time sensitivity, where Congress clearly could have acted.
Well, thank you for this. As always, so clear and so concise.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Gavin Newsom wrapped up his first legislative session as governor of California last night by signing or vetoing the last few bills on his desk. In total, Newsom gave his okay to more than 800 of the bills lawmakers sent to him this year. New protections for renters, abortion medication on college campuses, later start times for high school and middle school students. They're just a few of the changes Californians will see. But it hasn't all been smooth sailing for Jerry Brown's successor. A high-profile fight with anti-vaccine activists left many on both sides of the debate unsatisfied. And the public feuding with President Trump on environmental policy and the state's efforts to address homelessness shows no sign of slowing down. Well, to take a closer look at Newsom's first 10 months in office, I'm joined by Laurel Rosenhall. She covers California politics for Cal Matters. Hi, Laurel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So what do we know now, almost 1 year in? Have we pretty much gotten the governor that you expected from Newsom, the candidate?
I would say yes, in many ways, because he campaigned as an extremely progressive candidate, and he made a lot of relationships with Democrats in the legislature during his campaign time, including campaigning for many of them and donating money to their campaigns. And they did achieve a lot of goals, you know, expanding health care, expanding child care, expanding to 2 years of tuition-free community college. So in that regard, I think he did deliver. And I think the real question mark going into the beginning of his first year was, how much was he going to follow in Jerry Brown's footsteps versus how much was he going to carve his own path? Newsom is actually the first Democrat to follow another Democrat into the California's governor's office in more than 100 years. So we were all kind of curious how he would handle that piece of the job.
And before we get down to that, you just ran down some of the ways in which the governor delivered. What were some of the surprises for you?
You know, perhaps the biggest surprise kind of came late last night when he issued his very last round of veto messages. And there were a lot of them. And in the end, he vetoed more than 16% of the bills that he was sent, which, big picture, is a low number of vetoes, because still means that he signed almost 900 new laws. And it is hard for most of us to imagine that there's 900 problems that need a solution from the government. But he did say no to a lot of proposals from many from his fellow Democrats. And specifically, he did reject a lot of things that he said would be costly for state government. He did, you know, earlier in the year in the budget, approved spending a lot of money in the state budget. But then when it came down to bills that would require spending a lot more money, he said no to many of them, kind of taking a page out of the Jerry Brown playbook by saying, you know, I'm not going to support committing more money for something that we should instead do through the budget.
Getting to Newsom and his relationship to Jerry Brown's history and style of governance, what differences are you noticing?
Jerry Brown was highly selective about, you know, when he engaged with the public, when he engaged with the press, when he engaged even with lawmakers in the state capitol. Now, I wasn't there during his first two terms in the 70s and 80s. I wouldn't be surprised. It was very different then. He was a lot younger and getting started. But in recent years, you know, he would really only drop in and get in front of the TV cameras or organizing a meeting with legislators when he had a high priority. And he had a short list of priorities. You know, he had a couple of key things that he really cared about, among them criminal justice reform and climate change policy. And he really kind of went all in. Maybe each year in the legislature, he might pick one other kind of priority. And Newsom, just very different. You know, he came in with a laundry list of priorities. He was kind of, you know, had a million things he wanted to accomplish. And he had a very different style. He would, you know, he holds these lengthy press conferences where he talks to reporters and takes questions on a lot of issues. He's really made an effort to foster relationships with legislators, including, you know, having them into his office or attending events in their districts or whatnot. So he just seems to be much more engaged and probably more approaching it as someone whose political career is still rising, as opposed to someone whose political career is moving toward retirement.
What about as a manager? How does he compare to Jerry Brown? And is Governor Newsom a good manager?
He has really stumbled on a couple of things, despite all of the other accomplishments. There have been a couple areas in particular related to vaccine legislation and high-speed rail, where he sent a lot of mixed signals, and it left people very confused about who was in charge, what was the governor trying to accomplish. So he has gotten a lot of criticism in Sacramento for, you know, not running a very tight ship in a couple of areas.
And just briefly, looking ahead to the next year and the next 3 years, what are you concentrating on? What are you curious about? And how do you think Newsom might govern differently?
Well, on the Trump issue, you know, a lot of that will be determined by the outcome of next year's election for president. So that'll be very interesting to see. I expect that the Trump needling will escalate for all of 2020. And then if Trump gets reelected, I think that I wouldn't be surprised if Newsom eventually decides to run for president. But that's down the ways a bit and might not happen if a Democrat wins. And there's still, you know, there's a lot of issues that didn't get resolved this year that are left over till next year. On the housing front, Newsom has an incredibly ambitious goal to build more housing in California, and that is a lot more politically controversial in the Capitol than you might think. There is an issue regarding what some people call safe injection sites, which are these clinics where drug addicts could go and shoot up drugs under the supervision of a medical staff. And it's an effort to, you know, reduce overdoses and deaths on the streets. And that's been one that sort of stalled out over the last couple years. But there are some cities that really want to try doing this, and it would require a change of law. So that's something they'll take up again next year. And he's made a big move on the death penalty by basically calling an end to implementing the death penalty while he's governor. But that doesn't permanently end the death penalty in California, and a future governor could make a different decision. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's, you know, an effort in the kind of political election side of things
to take that up again.
Laurel, thanks for the perspective on this.
Good talking to you.
Laurel Rosenhall covers California politics for Cal Matters. Coming up, how do you responsibly explain the news of the day to kids?
For example, if we're covering a natural disaster or something, we want to be able to give them a way to help and a sense of agency rather than just leaving them with a vision of devastated homes and flooding and anything else that gives them anxiety.
The editor of Time Magazine for Kids, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Well, step into our shoes for a moment. Envision yourself a journalist trying to cover the complex and constantly evolving impeachment saga. President Trump, Ukraine, the so-called perfect phone call. Joe and Hunter Biden, a coup. Rudy Giuliani, treason. It's like drinking from a fire hose. Now imagine trying to distill this story down so that a child can understand it. It needs to be comprehensive and provide context, but still respectful of your audience without talking down to them or insulting their intelligence. Andrea Del Banco has these conversations every day in her newsroom. She's the editor-in-chief of Time for Kids, Time Magazine's publication for children in kindergarten through sixth grade. Andrea Del Banco, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have a tough job, and I noticed that you had a full impeachment explainer put together just a few days after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi formally launched the inquiry, and I really wished you'd been around when I was 11 and glued to the Watergate hearings on television. You made them much more comprehensible.
I wish we could have been of service, but Time for Kids started in 1995.
I know. I missed out. What is in that explainer?
Well, we took a close look at the process to try and explain to children how it works, since it's incredibly complicated. Even many adults don't totally understand it. So we started out with trying to explain how the system works and why it's in place. And we talked a little bit about why this is happening. We did a very light explainer about the situation with the investigation with Biden and why Nancy Pelosi is going in this direction and some of her reasoning in her words. And then we also tried to explain to children what could possibly happen next. I think one of the most important things we wanted to convey to them is that this is not an indication that we will have a different president any day now, or that there is radical instability, or that anything is very likely to change very quickly. I think it's a misconception, even among some adults, that that could happen. And so we wanted to kind of explain what are the next steps in this process and how long might that take.
I also noticed that you only included the impeachment explainer in your grades 3 through 6 edition, but not K-2. So what determines that cutoff age of second grade?
We have a very different approach to our magazines for children in kindergarten, first and second grade. In those years where children are learning to read, we really focus on shorter sentences, slightly easier topics, much more design and photos for context to help them, and we focus a lot on literacy as well as current events. For our 3rd to 6th grade readers, where they've transitioned from learning to read to reading to learn, we dump into much more complicated topics. It aligns well with what they're learning in school, with what the curriculum standards are, and really with the level at which they're able to comprehend what's happening in the world around them.
So do those developmental content guidelines always help you determine what to include in your coverage or how complex to make a topic like this?
I wish that it could be that simple. We have an absolutely fabulous curriculum team here with years of experience teaching and writing curriculum, and they work very closely with the curriculum guidelines. But a lot of it from the editorial side is also instinct and some level of creativity. And part of that is because, as we all know, children vary both within a single year of their lives and very much between 3rd and 6th grade, obviously. So we have to kind of take a nuanced approach to what level we think they can take in, even if it is right on grade level.
Yeah, this gets complicated. And you want to figure in what you mentioned in your first answer, that in some ways you want to reassure your readers, it sounds like, that the whole world's not falling apart.
Right.
You always keep in mind that not to scare them too much, right?
Right. That is always one of the major considerations we take into account each time we decide what news stories to cover, which we do on a daily basis here. We always want to be able to find some way to provide context and information that is slightly reassuring and clear, but also doesn't talk down to them or make any promises that we wouldn't be able to deliver on and predict any future outcomes. That's not our role. And wherever possible in certain situations, for example, if we're covering a natural disaster or something, we want to be able to give them a way to help and a sense of agency and a sense of what the community is doing to respond, rather than just leaving them with a vision of devastated homes and flooding and anything else that gives them anxiety.
Well, could you take me inside your editorial meeting and give me some examples of the conversations that you're having about how to achieve some of the objectives you're talking about?
Absolutely. We are a really close-knit team, so the steps that we take, we don't have to do quite as formally as I'm about to describe them. But basically, when we're talking about what's in the news, we examine the same set of five questions every time. First, is it topically age appropriate? That one is usually a pretty easy gut instinct. Second, is it of any interest or relevance to our readers? And if not, can we make it feel that way to them? Then also, is it our job to put that story into a classroom space, right? So this is different than having a conversation with your own child. We are writing to students all across the country in different schools, and that requires a different standard of making sure we are doing things that are appropriate, both from a grade level perspective and also just from a social and emotional perspective. Then we also have to think about how we can support teachers leading the conversations, since we know they'll have questions. So we always make sure that our curriculum guide with every story that we do gives the teachers the confidence and the background information to be able to take the lesson wherever it may lead. And then the last thing, is there some way we can give kids a sense of agency or optimism or involvement to kind of link back to this concept that even though they're young, they're too young to vote, they don't have much of a voice, they can still be involved in anything and everything.
Well, yeah, you have so many considerations to think about. And that kind of, in some ways, leads me to my next question, which is time for kids journalism? Or is it educational material?
That's a great question, and it's one that is on my mind every single day. I have been a Time for Kids for 14 years, and I still can't answer that entirely. What I can say is we deliver journalism that is entirely fact-based and authoritative, and we're really trying to teach best practices with kids with news literacy to teach them to understand and recognize, let alone value, authentic journalism. But what we don't do is take an opinion or put any kind of persuasive content in without very clearly labeling it. And though I think many media organizations consider that to be their MO, for us, it's really the most important thing. Again, as a classroom publication, we really are not in a position to be able to put any ideas in children's minds other than facts and context and information from which they can make their own conclusions.
What story have you found the trickiest to cover for your audience?
The Parkland shootings. That was the biggest challenge for me that I have faced in the 14 years that I've been here. The first was the challenge of whether or not we should cover it. We have historically very cautiously avoided covering any school shootings, partly for the obvious reasons that it's very upsetting. Any sort of terrorism is upsetting, but also because we really don't want to put teachers in a position of teaching their children a story that then makes them anxious in that environment, which teachers work so hard to make feel secure and comfortable. So this was a break with tradition for us to cover that story. And so just the decision to do it was hard enough.
And why did you decide to do it?
It felt like a critical mass and a critical moment and something that we just couldn't ignore. And also, one of the most important ways in which it felt right for us to cover it was that there was the right angle, the perfect Time for Kids angle into it, which was that children in the aftermath were being vocal, they were meeting with their legislators, they were getting together to talk about what was important, and they were being heard. And we really wanted to show our readers, rather than focusing on the horror, which we lightly touched on, obviously, we wanted to show them that even these young kids were able to make change and demand that their schools be more safe and have their voices heard at a national level. In any other school shooting scenario we've confronted, there was really no angle I could conceive of to talk about an important lesson that came out of it or to give it any kind of structure that might make them feel some level of optimism. And this was just a really good moment to teach children about activism and community and to give them, as you said, a sense of agency even before they're old enough to vote or to have much participatory engagement in these kinds of things.
Andrea, thank you so much for this conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Andrea DelBanco is the editor-in-chief of Time for Kids. For 40 years, North Hollywood's Palomino Club was a legendary destination for country music stars and their fans. Now it's back tomorrow night for one last concert, one last ride. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Madeline Brand. For our Monday music segment, we're going back in time to when Los Angeles was a country music destination, thanks to one small honky-tonk in the valley.
Welcome to the world-famous Palomino Club.
The stage at North Hollywood's Palomino Club has hosted the likes of Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Patsy Cline, Merle Haggard, and Linda Ronstadt. The list goes on, really. The Palomino was the West Coast's premier country music destination for 40 years, up until it closed in the 90s. But tomorrow, the historic Palomino will ride again for one night of music and dancing. Country music trio Midland is collaborating with the Valley Relics Museum in Van Nuys to bring the club back to life for a concert. And joining me now to talk about the fabled Palomino Club is the founder of the Valley Relics Museum, Tommy Gelinas. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Barbara, and it's such an honor to be able to talk about the history of the Palomino. So I'm really excited for this interview.
Tommy, you're a lifelong Valley resident. What's your personal connection to the Palomino and what made it so special?
Well, you know, growing up in the San Fernando Valley, there was a lot of different businesses, manufacturers, drive-ins, car culture, and it was just this great time to grow up in California, especially in the Valley, with everything that was going on here. And the Palomino was right across the street from one of my brother's businesses. So when I was 10 years of age, you know, we would cruise up Sherman Way and then make a right on Lancashire. And I would always see, you know, all the names that were on Hee-Haw. And my parents loved watching Hee-Haw. And
that's great.
Right. So when I would, you know, and we were kind of forced, you know, to watch that. But, you know, you'd drive by the old Palomino and I'd see Buck Owens or Johnny Cash on the bill. And I'm like, you know, asking my brother, are they really going to be there? Is that where they film Hee-Haw? And then later on, they started bringing in more rock and roll bands, such as the Red Hot Chili Peppers, to Elvis Costello and many others. So even though I didn't frequent the club in its heyday of country music, I was there quite a bit towards the last 5 years of that club. And then many years later, preserving local history, it was such a treasure trove of information, and there was so much historical significance to that iconic venue that I became so infatuated learning everything about that club and why it was so important and why it disappeared along with many other establishments, venues, and businesses here in the Valley.
You know, I love some of the stories that people tell about what a celebrity magnet the club was, too. I mean, I remember reading a waitress who worked there, the cocktail waitress, talking about Linda Ronstadt being a fixture there, and Liza Minnelli was a fan of Tony Booth, the leader of the house band, the Palomino Riders. Hugh Hefner often arrived with his teenage companion Barbie Benton, according to this cocktail waitress. I mean,
Wild.
And that's all true.
Wild.
And, many more. And that's just the effect that it had, you know, on that area, on our community, on our culture. It was such a great, and, you know, being able to read that billboard and see those famous people on there many years later, you know, to learn that history, man, just so many celebrities just loved that place.
Now, why country music? How did that even start, the Palomino?
Well, yeah, originally before the Palomino, before the Thomas Brothers took over that location, it was called the Mule Kick in the 40s. And it was a pretty rundown bar, and they were looking for a location. And, you know, honestly, probably when, you know, they walked in there and the smell of cigarettes and alcohol and whatever else, I think they had found their home, and just like a good old country song. And, you know, at that time, you know, there wasn't a lot of venues, especially locally. And, you know, it's in the middle of North Hollywood in an area that's very industrial. And thinking that, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s, that people like Johnny Cash and, you know, Merle Haggard to Jerry Lee Lewis to the Everly Brothers and all of them driving either, you know, from Hollywood or one part of the valley or even from Nashville or Texas to come and play at that venue.
I'm thinking that people listening to us, you know, when you think of California's music influence now, country music doesn't really leap to mind unless you know your music history. But it was a whole different story back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. So just remind us of the country scene back then and how it does figure into the history of the California sound.
Right, it does. And I think that the California sound, you know, is something that really started at the Palomino. And, you know, and today Nashville is trying to take the credit for that California sound. I remember going there one night and watching Dwight Yoakam open for Lone Justice. How crazy is that? And a lot of that sound and a lot of that music originated from California. And especially in the Valley, there were so many clubs that you could go and listen to a local new country band or a celebrity band play. And you had, you know, right down the street from the Palomino, you had Haggard's Place, which was Merle Haggard's bar that was down the street, and so many others that were throughout that area. It was something that was very popular, maybe at some point a trend, but it was a trend that really resonated for many years locally and now is global.
Well, I want to play a clip, and this is a clip from one of those stars that just kept on coming back to the Palomino long after they hit stardom. I think we'll all know who it is.
Got a gal called Nettie, she chill up a heart. I know when I roll, she know how to rock when I'm rocking. Oh, yeah, my life away. My name is Jerry Lee Lewis, and I'm damn sure here to stay.
The great Jerry Lee Lewis, of course, playing the Pal in 1979, and he was a regular there?
Yes, he sure was, and you'll see a lot of photos on the internet and floating through social media of him there. And, you know, Tommy Thomas believed that when a band would come to the Palomino and the old cowboy way, and especially when they were up and coming or fairly new to the scene, you know, the Thomas Brothers really believed that when you would come to audition and if they liked you and you were just getting started, the whole cowboy handshake was like, look, it, if we give you the opportunity to play at this club, it might not be a lot of money, but if we give you the opportunity to play here and you make it big, then you have to come back and play here again.
The lore is just so great about the Thomas Brothers. I think I read somewhere that, again, Tommy Thomas didn't really know music that well, and he took a lot of cues from all the waitresses, the cocktail waitress who worked there, one waitress, Mona, who did know music and kind of kept her ear to the radio, and she told him to book Merle Haggard for the first time.
Right. And originally when the club opened in like right around 1949, 1950, there was a few partners that had opened that club prior, and then the Thomas Brothers bought it. And they're the ones that really made the club what it was. And, You know, it was because of them that club became what the club was. So, you know, that was kind of, you know, I just wanted to just clarify that, you know, and I think that, like, with any good business, you know, if it opened in 49 and by 1950, the Thomas Brothers, you know, early 50s, they owned it. It was from 1950 into the 90s that they ran that club. And it, you know, you might not know what you're doing. Like for me, I might not know how to play a music instrument perfectly, but I know what good music sounds like. And you got to have an ear for it. So they were doing something right.
Yeah, getting back to that Jerry Lee Lewis clip, I know someone else remembers seeing Jerry Lee Lewis play at the Pal, and Leon Russell jumped up to play with him.
Absolutely.
And then Glenn Campbell jumped in?
Absolutely.
I mean,
I mean, you know, it's what a place, you know, where that many celebrities would hang out there, from Nudie Cohn, the famous rodeo tailor, to Glenn Campbell and many others. It's just amazing, you know, how it was such a magnet for celebrities.
But even all that star power couldn't keep the doors open.
Right. And like I was saying, you know, it's interesting, like with trends, you know, I think that in some cases, you know, it's a smaller venue. It only holds right around 300 people. The parking lot's only so big. And I think what happens as time goes on, the music changes. And, you know, you have, you know, classic rock, which I really like. And, you know, but it's different today. And I think the considering the area that it's in, it's always been in a seedy part of the valley. And it's always been slightly run down. But through all that, it survived many years. But unfortunately, I feel that some of the style of music changed. It was hard to keep the momentum going. And, you know, once both of the Thomas Brothers passed away, it was very difficult for Tommy Thomas's wife to continue to run it.
But the bright spot, tomorrow night, you're having a concert there, thanks to you and this band, Midland, which will be performing. And tell me about them.
They remind me a lot of kind of like 70s, early 80s country music. So it's a little bit, I feel, it just has that warm kind of country, you know, classic country music. And, you know, kind of what you would probably hear at the Palomino, you know, in the late 80s.
Sounds great. Why don't we hear a clip from their new album? The song is called Put the Hurt on Me.
Give me something, baby, with your kiss. If I go, I wanna go like this. Come on, be as cool as you can be. Yeah, baby, put the hurt on me.
So is that the sound of the Palomino?
You know what? Yes, it does have a that. You can tell that there's influence in that. And they're such a great band, and, you know, people love them. And just like with any good, you know, old-school rock and roll band, you know, there's a lot of influence from a lot of the blues bands and things like that. You can hear it in there, and I really feel what a great fit for Midland to bring it back to the roots of country music and where a lot of it started.
Well, here's what Midland's bass player Cameron Duddy had to say about the Palomino.
It's important for us to bring it back for this one night only because I feel like it does kind of signify our allegiance to the old times. It was a scene, man. I wish we had been around back then to have seen it.
And it's a venue that is really distinctive. Will the inside look the same tomorrow night?
Well, we're going to bring the huge Palomino neon sign, the original one. And then what we do is we have a way of pipe and draping the inside. And then we have props that were made from a friend of mine. We call him Denver Dan, that had made all the props. And some of the old posters and signs that were in the inside will decorate that area. So the stage, you're going to feel like you're back in the Palomino. It's going to be amazing.
That's just wonderful. I hope it goes so well. And thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Tommy Gelinas, he's the founder of the Valley Relics Museum.
Girl, you already got me. Go on and throw out the
keep. You lock me up with your body. That's the only way I'll ever be free. Give me something, baby, with your kiss.
That's it for us for today. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast and listen whenever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get podcasts. I'm Barbara Kapoke. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.
Don't have to promise tomorrow. I know that's only in life. But one more taste of your sweet poison.